This world is beyond cruelty. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades. My family's been fighting them for centuries. And they were massacred. Alongside my father.
Your father didn't believe in revenge.
We believe in Fremen.
Let me fight beside you.
Reload! I won't be fighting for him. I'm fighting for my people.
You young pup.
Do you believe in Paul?
There are signs.
The prophet. Why is that a bad thing? Use it.
Because all my visions lead to horror.
Because you lose control.
Because I gain it. Johnny, do you believe in me?
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Robcast. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, it's a true delight to be joined by my friend and dear co-host, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it's a pleasure to be here, but I'm slightly confused, Rob. I thought we were calling this podcast now Rob and Rob's Softcore Fumblings.
Yes, updated for this one to Rob and Rob's Sandy Softcore Fumblings.
I thought you were going to go a little bit further with a sandworm evocation, but...
Oh, no, why is that? No, thank you. Yep, okay, yep, that's a thing that is in my head now. So, Rob, for the sake of our audience's sanity, what are we talking about in today's episode?
Well, obviously, the Softcore Fumblings was a reference to the last episode, but in this episode, we are talking about Dune Part 2, the concluding installment of Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Frank Herbert's 1965 novel Dune. But how concluding it is, we'll get into in the discussion of the movie. So yes, and I'm sure that we're going to have something to say about the film.
Yes, a bit of a surprise and a bit of a pointless endeavour if we didn't. We have nothing to say about this one. 2.5 hour sci-fi epic, and yeah, it was all right. You know, ticked a couple of boxes.
Well, 2 hours and 46 minutes. I mean, this one I think is 10 minutes longer than the original, and we'll get into that as well. But before we begin, should I do the IMDb synopsis?
Yes, I have no idea how good or bad the IMDb synopsis for this film is going to be, because sometimes you get indie ones that are actually quite good, and sometimes you get big Hollywood releases, and you're like, who wrote this?
Yeah, indeed, that's right. Actually, this one's not bad, because the broad arc of the film is quite simple. So, Paul Atreides unites with Charney and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family.
I mean, yeah, yes, kind of it. Though, if you haven't seen part one, or I guess if you're coming after this, you know, if in the future when this isn't all quite so in the public consciousness, people are going to probably be like, who was Paul Atreides and Charney and the Fremen? And isn't this meant to be in space? This sounds, you know, yeah, it's fine. It's very functional. It just doesn't give any idea of scope.
All right, Mr. Picky. That's the thing, I think. With this film, we have to assume that anyone listening to this has seen Dune Part 1, because this is all payoff to what happens in Dune Part 1. So yes, as the IMDb synopsis said, this is about Paul Atreides, also known as Mauld Dib. It's one of those films where it's a sci-fi fantasy movie where lots of people have lots of different names. So it's kind of Game of Thrones-y like that. The sci-fi and fantasy purists are gnashing their teeth right now. So Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, who's having a very good beginning to the year. Charney is played by Zendaya, and the Fremen are led by Stilgar, who's played by Javier Bardem, who had a cameo in the previous film. Anyone that can remember the events of the last film, in, I think it's the year 10,000 and something, and there are houses of families that rule the galaxy, and the House Atreides is given stewardship of the planet Arrakis, also known as Dune. It's a very, very lucrative stewardship, because that means they can mine a precious spice on this planet, on this sand planet, and this spice enables interstellar travel. So it's very, very precious.
If you huff it, it gives you precognitive abilities.
Yes, you get visions of things that may or may not come to pass. That's right.
Which is why I regularly drink petrol.
Yeah, indeed. Does it give you precog?
It definitely has an impact on cog.
Yeah, so you kind of forget your name. And,
yeah, exactly.
I think at some point in the future, I'm going to remember my name.
Exactly. Not...
It happened. I could see the future.
Exactly. Not only can I not perceive the future, I can no longer perceive the past.
It's all about the terrible present. So anyway, and in Dune Part 1, the House Atreides are betrayed, and the House Harkonnen, who are the baddies, the Boo-Hiss villains, basically stage a coup and destroy the House Atreides. Paul and his mother, the Lady Jessica, have to flee into the desert, or into the rest of the planet, and are found by the Fremen, who are an indigenous people to the planet, and they basically have to earn their trust. In Dune Part 2, we continue that story. This then gets into things like Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem, thinks that Paul is a messiah who has been foretold in their religion. And things happen that just really confirm Stilgar's belief in this. On the other hand, we have Chani, who forms a relationship with Paul, and she thinks that this religious prophecy is just a means of control, and that religion is just a means of keeping people in their place. But she has this loving relationship with Paul, so there is a tension there. The bigger tension comes from the fact that the House Harkonnen are still trying to kill them, and are also trying to basically crush the indigenous life on Dune so that they can mine the spice in peace. Is there anything else to add to that, Rob?
No, I think that's a... there was a point in this quite early on where I thought, oh no, I might have just ruined it for myself. Not because I predicted a spoiler, but there's literally a point where Stilgar says, the Mahdi is too humble to say he is the Mahdi. And my brain, of course, immediately went to, all right then, I am the Messiah.
Yes, I thought that. I did get a Life of Brian moment where it's like, only the true Messiah would deny his divinity. What does that mean? All right, then, I am the Messiah. He is the Messiah.
And then immediately after that, they start doing the kind of sandworm, the walk in order to avoid the worms. And I was like, so great, we've gone straight from Life of Brian to Ministry of Silly Walks.
Yes, there are things in this that shouldn't work, and it's the bold swings of like, well, if we're going to do the book, then we have to be true to the logic of the book, which means that, yes, Under the Planet, and everyone who's listening to this, I'm sure, has seen Dune Part 1 or the David Lynch film. Under the planet, there are these huge sandworms. Some of them are 400 metres. And you have to walk in a certain way so that they don't pick up on the rhythm of your walking and basically come and get you, because you'll be a mid-morning snack for them. This film has a huge cast. So Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson plays the Lady Jessica, Paul's mum. Josh Brolin plays Gunny. He's Paul's... Well, he was Paul's father's right-hand man and now kind of sees himself in that position for Paul.
There's Stellan Skarsgård as the Baron Harkonnen. Charlotte Rampling as the Reverend Mother Moham, who is basically the leader of the Bene Gesserit, who are essentially a order of kind of psychic nuns set to bring about the rise of the Mahdi. There's also Florence Pugh, introduction of Florence Pugh as Princess Arulan, who is the daughter of the Emperor, played by Christopher Walken. I like Christopher Walken. I did find his presence in this a little distracting.
Before we get onto that, just very, very quickly, before the Dune heads send out a kill team, it's actually the Bene Gesserit, not
okay.
Gesserit.
There we go.
Again, it's one of those sort of films. Yeah, Christopher Walken in this plays the Emperor of...
making it worse. Sorry.
No, it's good. There's going to be lots of Life of Brian in this. Yeah, Christopher Walken plays the Emperor of the Universe. He is in a subdued mode for this. He's in his kind of hushed Christopher Walken mode. But yes, we have Dave Bautista is back as the Beast Raban, but he's also joined by Austin Butler as Fade Rauther, who is his brother, and they are Harkonnen, and they're not very nice people, to be honest. They are the Boo-Hiss villains. They're the nephews of the Baron Harkonnen, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's all, and they, you know, they're all dressed in black, and they're all very pale, and it's all very, very Empire. And a little bit Borgy, some of the kind of facial prostheses that people wear. And also, yeah, the sequence is set on...
That's the Borg from Star Trek, is it?
Yes. And yeah, also the sequence is set on the planet Harkonnen, the name of which temporarily escapes me, are pretty much shot in black and white, which reminded me very much of Thor, God and Thunder. the black and white sequences in Thor: God and Thunder when they go to Gore's planet, especially with Butler looking quite a lot like Christian Bale in that movie.
Yes, he does. He does look a bit like Christian Bale. That's right. So the Harkonnen planet is at Gedi Prime.
All just made up words. Made up words.
That's the thing, is that they actually made up the Fremen language in this. I was watching an interview with Denis Villeneuve on the Stephen Colbert show, and there's some interesting little factoids he was coming out that we'll get onto as we talk about the film, including that monochrome sequence set on Gedi Prime. But before we get granular with what we thought about Dune, what are your broad thoughts about Dune Part 2?
It is spectacular. You know, it is intelligent sci-fi done on an epic scale. Yeah, the fact that we got part two, I mean, the first one did very well, and apparently the second one is raking in the bucks.
All right.
It's definitely come a kind of a good pop culture moment. I mean, because literally just before the film started, there was a trailer for Challengers, which is the other film with Zendaya in it coming out this year.
Is that the Woody Harrelson one?
No, that's this is the...
That's Champions, I'm thinking of, sorry.
Yes, this is the Luca Guadagnino film with Josh O'Connor and Mike Faist about tennis players.
Oh, yes, indeed. That's right. Yes, I have seen a still of that.
And there was also another trailer featuring an actor whose presence in the film we haven't mentioned but may reveal in spoilers.
Yes, I think I know who... Yes, I know who you mean. Obviously, Timothy Chalamet is coming off of the hit of Wonka, and I get the tube home from Piccadilly Circus. And when I go down to the platform, at the moment, I am walking past a Wonka poster right next to a Dune 2 poster. And it's like, yeah, Timothy Chalamet is having a pretty good moment right now.
He's got two
massive movies. The chocolate must flow, that's right.
I would watch Dune the musical.
So, yeah, I've watched Dune the musical.
or a film where Wonka has to like join the Oompa Loompas in a guerrilla insurgency against...
Well, that kind of happens in Wonka, doesn't
it? That kind of happens in Wonka.
So did you like Dune 2?
Yeah, no, I really did. I was engaged throughout its runtime. Again, it's visually stunning. It's amazing how engaging you can make a film that's predominantly shot in shades of orange and brown, but...
That's right, yeah, it is. It's orange, brown and monochrome are largely the colour schemes, and it's still a visual spectacle. It is very, very clever the way that the film is put together in that way. Yeah, I have to admit, I did like this one. I didn't like it as much as the first one, and the reason why is because I thought that even though this film has a leisurely running time of 2 hours and 45 minutes, there is still a lot of plot to get in. There's not really a lot of downtime in this film. But even with that said, I thought that some of the secondary characters, their subplots were kind of resolved in quite a quick way, I thought. There were some, I thought, oh, that could have done with a bit more time to properly wrap that up. So there were certain elements there. I also thought there were some things that seemed a little bit rushed, as if they were just trying to ride the sandworm of the Dune story, because it's such an expansive story. I mean, you could make a 4-part miniseries of this, and I think they actually did, didn't they? They did in the early 2000s, there was a Dune miniseries. Yeah, you could easily give... So this comes in about 5 hours, I think, the two films together. You could easily add like another 2 hours onto that. So there were elements of it that I thought characters were introduced and then resolved quite quickly. And there's a public service announcement that I think I have to give. And it's not as... Even though it's about the ending, I don't think it's a spoiler. I actually think it's something that you kind of need to know to prime yourself, is that even though this tells the Dune story, it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. And myself and the audience I was watching it with were not prepared for that ending. Because I was thinking, wow, you've got... This has been on for a long time and it seems to be wrapping up, but there's a lot of loose threads here that need to be tied off. And you're not going to be able to do that in... Unless someone just comes on and says what happened, much like at the beginning of Dune, the David Lynch film, when Virginia Madsen, who plays the Princess Irulan, comes on and basically gives a 5-minute monologue about what the film's going to be about. And... I thought, unless you're going to do that, I don't see how you can wrap this up. But it doesn't. It doesn't wrap it up. There are still really big plot threads hanging. The audience I was with, you could feel the surprise there. And in some ways, it wasn't a nice surprise. It was like, oh, well, is it going to be another one? Because, of course, the first Dune came out and there was no guarantee that Dune 2 was going to happen. It was greenlit 4 days after the first Dune was released because the first Dune was a hit. I mean, I think it did something like 450 million at the box office around the world at a time when we were still really, really in a COVID period. So it was a hit and we got this film. But it's like, Denny, can you stop doing this, please? Can you stop leaving us with cliffhangers for films that might not happen? It seems to be that there is going to be another one. He seems to be pretty confident that there's going to be another one. But this is through Warner Brothers. And we know that Warner Brothers, over the past 3 years or so, have this wonderful habit of, even if they make the film, they'll shelve it. So there's no guarantee they're going to put a lot of money into making another film if this one doesn't do well. Now, it's very good that you said it's already raking in the bucks. And I think it will do well. It is very spectacular. There are some amazing action sequences in it. And overall, I really like this movie.
I think it's currently the highest rated film on IMDb.
Yeah, it's 9.0. But I always think that's a bit of a non-story, because it's like, well, yeah, every film starts off big. It's like, come back a week from now, see where it is then. Again, it's just those kind of like clickbait articles where Dune 2 is the biggest film on IMDb now. What did it beat? It beat The Shawshank Redemption or The Godfather or something like that. But come back a week from now and then anyway, blah, blah, blah. This is all just the distraction that we've decided is now film criticism. But yeah, I did think, okay, that was your ending. That was interesting. And the audience was like, you could just, yeah, as I said, you could just feel the surprise. But very quickly, did you see this in IMAX or on like a regular screen?
I saw this on a regular screen.
Yeah, me too. I went to a press screening of this, but because I was a little bit late, because I saw there was a massive queue and it was raining and I thought I'll come back in a few minutes after going to the comic shop, the main IMAX screen at the Cineworld Leicester Square was full by the time I got there, so I saw it in the impact screen, which is not bad. Although one of the speakers was distorting a bit. That was a shame. But anyway. But yes, I saw it on the impact screen, which is still a lovely big screen. And you're right, it is a spectacle. The grand vision of this movie, it is huge. It is a huge vision. It feels like one of those films from the 50s and 60s that was a proper epic when widescreen was introduced as an industry norm. So lots of films have been shot in CinemaScope and things like that. It just has that huge feel to it.
Yeah, I kind of got almost a, well, definitely the Blade Runner influences are there in terms of the technology. But you're almost going to Blade Runner meets Lawrence of Arabia. Although I know that you don't like Lawrence of Arabia, so...
And I wasn't a huge fan of Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049 either, but it's still a good comparison. But yes, I do find Lawrence of Arabia a very dull movie. It's also one of those things where there's an action skirmish at the beginning of this film, and then it settles down into a bit of a family drama for, I don't know, it would be interesting to watch it again, but about half hour, 40 minutes, where it patiently lays out all of the character schemings and motivations that are then going to tell the rest of the story. And you really get immersed in the culture of the Fremen and the way that Paul and Jessica are having to become part of that. And you have to tip your hat to it that it says it's not all going to be action. We are going to very, very patiently spend time with these people and look at this culture and really immerse ourselves in this. And we're going to treat it with a very straight bat and we're going to be intelligent about this story. That I thought was very good.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few humorous moments in the film, mostly courtesy of Stilgar, Javier Bardem, being very, either very matter-of-fact or very enthusiastic. Yeah, I totally get what you say about the supporting characters. A lot of them just feel like they're there almost to sort of more to serve like a narrative and thematic purpose, that this is about power structures. You've got Princess Arulan as like chainmail Power Ranger costume. making entries in her diary being like, this will be narratively important.
I did think that her character name was previously on Dune at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because she basically just recaps the first one, which I think is also necessary. Because the first one came out 2 years ago. And of course, this film was supposed to come out in November, but was held back because of the actors' strike, because they wanted the actors to be out there to promote the film, which I think is right as well. I think that this, even though this is it's a good movie, it's a big spectacle, you get your money's worth, it is also a sci-fi film that is a sequel to a sci-fi film that came out 2 years ago. I do think that you need the big stars there to sell the film as well. And that's the thing. Have you read Dune?
Yes, though not for a very long time.
Right, okay. Because that's the thing about sci-fi, which I don't think is always a valid criticism, but often they'll say a criticism of sci-fi is that characters are only there to serve plot and they're ciphers more than fleshed out people. Do you remember that being the case with Dune?
I think it's the fact that if you're going to create a world, there are going to be characters who don't have that much focus on them. And whether you're there to kind of fulfill a narrative purpose, the actors portraying them in both in this and in the original Dune, well, the previous movie, are given pretty much enough to work with and are engaging enough of themselves to kind of justify. I wasn't at any point thinking, oh God, not more of this.
Yeah, because Dune is one of those books. I tried to read Dune. I got about 50 pages in and just couldn't get on with it. That was before the first film. But Dune is this... it's just this worm in my mind that I just think I just have to read the book. This so appeals to me. Even the David Lynch film, which is a complete mess, has these flashes of brilliance in it and these really odd ideas and images that come from the book. And I just think that at some point I'm going to have to read Dune because, yeah, as I said, this just so appeals to me, this story and this world and the characters and the ideas there. And I was reading about it on Wikipedia and just the amount of research that Frank Herbert put in to Dune. I think it was like 5 years of research. He was researching other cultures, obviously Middle Eastern cultures, and Messiah narratives and all those things. And it's like, well, all this ticks my boxes. I think I'm going to have to just get Dune, go to a pub one day and just sit down and say, right, this is what I'm doing today. I'm going to crack Dune and I'm going to get to that point where you reach the tipping point and realise you are going to read the book. Because 50 pages are like, oh, I'm just not committed. And then I just wasn't, yeah, and I just stopped.
Okay, I thought you were going to imply that you were going to go to a pub and read the whole of Dune. I was like, Rob, you're not leaving that pub. You're going to be there a while.
Well, that was the thing because a friend of mine said, why don't you listen to the audiobook? And it's like, well, I'm not one that can really listen to audio books. I don't think I just can't really concentrate on a book as much as I can a podcast when I'm walking around. But also, I said, well, how long is it? And he said, it's 20 hours. So I'm not going to spend 20 hours listening to the story of Dune whilst walking to the shops and walking to work and stuff like that. It's like, no, I can't do that. It's either reading or nothing. So we'll see how that goes. So what were some of the other parts of this that you thought were quite spectacular?
Riding the sandworm, certainly.
Yeah, it really nails it, doesn't it?
Yeah, the fact that this is a absolutely mammoth creature whose size when it's moving across the sand plains towards you, but when it's up close, you almost it's almost kind of inconceivable, as you say, because you know they can grow up to kind of 400 meters, and you've got something that's like, to quote another film I saw yesterday, I finally watched the crocodile film Rogue. It's like a steam train with teeth, and yeah, you've got that rushing past you, and you're trying to jump on its back.
It's interesting when you watch the David Lynch version of that, because of course it's all front projection and rear projection and massive practical model effects that the actors are holding on to. None of it looks real. It kind of looks so bizarre that it kind of works in a way, but it does look, you do kind of giggle at it a bit. Whereas in this one, it's like, well, this is obviously how far we've come in special effects in the last 40 odd years or whatever, or 35 years or whatever. But yeah, this does look real. Yeah, the freight train analogy is an apt one, because when Paul, and it's in the trailer, when Paul has to ride the sandworm, it does speed by and you do get the impression that it's trying to hold on to a train and it's rushing by and it does seem very dangerous. Yeah, that was great. There's also a point when they attack a Harkonnen spice mining machine, and it's this huge, huge machine in the desert. And that was a great action scene, I thought. That kind of reminded me of the Battle of Algiers. I actually think that this could be Blade Runner, Lawrence of Arabia, and the Battle of Algiers. All these films are kind of being pulled into Dune 2, which again is like, well, that's great. It's great to have that level of ambition.
Yeah, so there was one moment in it, which, and I'm very much glad they didn't, where I thought they were going to reveal that a fight that was happening was actually prescient, was actually like a vision that Paul was having, and then flashback. You know, we didn't talk about Madam Web on the pod. I was like, oh no, please don't do a Madam Web where you basically just keep doing the twist from the end of the, and this is going to be a spoiler for the 2007 Nicolas Cage movie Next, where you just keep revealing that the fight sequence you've just seen didn't actually happen yet.
Yes, indeed. I haven't seen Madam Web. I am going to watch Madam Web.
Don't.
When it comes to Home Ends.
There are other... Have you seen Morbius?
No.
Morbius is better than Madam Web.
Wow.
Because one thing about Madam Web's power is it's essentially passive.
I don't know. That is... But if it is, then that's a failure of the writing, because being able to predict the future and then having to try and change the future is a very active thing. I mean, that's the plot of 12 Monkeys, right? So I would say that if it is passive, then it's a fault of the writing, which is also why I want to see it, because Dakota Johnson on her publicity tour for the film has been absolutely hilarious. She keeps coming out with things that you can see the PR people saying, oh, stop talking like that. Like saying the film it turned out to be was very, very different to the script that I signed up to. It's like, okay, well, that doesn't bode well.
The script I signed up to wasn't shit.
Well, the thing is, isn't it? Because I really like Dakota Johnson. I think she's a great actor. And I hear that in this one, it's like she is you can see the contempt that she has for the project in her performance. And it's like, well, I have to see that. I want to see how yet another Spider-Verse film is just no. Because, of course, what's the other one that's coming out?
Oh, Kraven.
Kraven, yeah. Which was supposed to be out, but apparently was pushed back because the writer's strike again, like Dune was. But it's like, I think they might be some reshoots and stuff in that. But anyway, yeah, I can actually think of that scene in Dune 2 where you thought it might be a flash forward, but we can talk about that in spoilers. The scene on Geedi Prime, which is like a gladiatorial scene, isn't it? It's when we're introduced to Fade Rautha, played by Austin Butler, unrecognisable. I mean, he is under some pretty impressive prosthetic makeup. It's like, this guy played Elvis, and he is, well, as you said, he looks like Christian Bale in Thor, God and Thunder. Love and Thunder, that was called. That scene outside in that big arena was filmed with infrared cameras.
Ah, okay.
To get that look. And that's why the skin is very, very translucent and you can see the veins and stuff, and why everything kind of has that weird sheen to it. And the reason in film why it looks that way is because they have a black sun, which again is just a great idea. It's so the light is completely different and alien. It looks so alien. Those weird fireworks going off in the sky that I think the Empire review said looked like...
Yeah, they're all either black or white.
Yeah, and the Empire review kind of said they look like Rorschach blots. And it's like, yeah, it does. This is a very odd look to this film. And you're not getting this in other films. I'm sure there's nothing like that in Madame Web.
Well, it's very funny that you've just said that. There's something visually that's the tiniest bit like Madame Web, like that in Madame Web. And also fireworks play quite a crucial role in a scene in Madame Web.
Oh, wow. Okay. See, and you just told me that I shouldn't see Madame Web. This is just making me want to see it even more. But Denis Villeneuve did say to the studio, the thing is with this, if we do this, then this is what it is. There's no way to get colour into this. We can't go back. So this is what we're doing. It's going to look great. Are you fine with that? Are you fine with the fact that this is what it's going to look like?
And they're like, Denny, we've already funded this. Like, we're funding this now. We're going to have to kind of trust you at this point. Like, if we were going to fuck around, we would have fucked around with Dune, like the original Dune. We're not going to fuck around with Dune Part 2, because it's a no-win situation.
I don't know, you say that, but it's Warner Brothers. Who knows what Warner Brothers are going to do? They've got a Wile E. Coyote film that, by all accounts, is a really good, enjoyable movie that would make money, and they're selling it to a streaming service because they don't want to release it. Nothing they do right now can be predicted. So yeah, I think that it probably right of Denis Villeneuve to say, this is what we're doing again. Don't want you to get silly about this later on. And it was great to see these big stars in the film as well. That again gave it an epic feel, like an old school epic feel, where you get the stars in because the stars will bring the people in. As much as the spectacle sometimes. I mean, I was thinking it's such good casting that you've got Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya in this film because they're going to bring in a younger audience who aren't, well, who know nothing about Dune, probably don't even know that there was a previous Dune film, and might not really be into the idea of a desert sci-fi film with big worms. Again, that's just really, really good casting.
Going quickly back to Christopher Walken, you know, I really like him as an actor, and as you say, he was subdued in this. And I don't know, it might have been the same if Robert De Niro or Al Pacino had popped up in like a bit part. But I wish we'd heard Christopher Walken actually say the word spice.
Yeah.
Even in like understated mode, I think his delivery of that would have been something to behold.
Does anyone actually call the planet Dune?
Only Timothée Chalamet at one point.
Does he? Okay, right.
There is a very Family Guy, he said the name of the movie moment.
Oh, right. I missed that because it's the planet Arrakis, and they, yeah, are all calling it Arrakis. And it's like, is it called Dune at any point?
I think it's supposed to be that only the colonizers call it Arrakis. Traditionally, the Fremen have called it Dune.
Yeah, but none of them are. But they don't.
I guess because they don't need to talk about the planet that they live on, because it's like, we live here.
Well, we talk about Earth. I mean, we say Earth a lot. Yeah, you're destroying the Earth.
When's the last time you said Earth?
Well, when people say, you are destroying the Earth, people do say Earth.
Stop saying Earth. You're giving it...
And also, it's like, if it's in the film, it's like, because it's not unusual for someone to say, you're destroying the Earth, it wouldn't be unusual in the film for someone to say they are destroying Dune, one of the Fremen. But yes, okay, right. So, all right, well, when I watch it again, and I will definitely watch it again, and this is also, of course, a 4K purchase, so I can go next to my copy of Dune on the shelf, and I can have a big Saturday afternoon watching 5 hours of Dune hopefully it will then be joined by Dune Part 3, which will be based on the book Dune Messiah, so we'll see what they call that. Anyway, but I will listen out for it. Did you watch Hodorowski's Dune?
Not yet. It is on my to-do list. Actually, I might end up doing that today because I've got some free time this afternoon.
Right. I recommended to Rob that he watch a documentary, which I think is available to rent on Amazon Prime. I've got a Blu-ray of it, called Hodorowski's Dune. And very, very quickly about Hodorowski's Dune, because it is a fascinating movie. So Alejandro Hodorowski is a Chilean-French filmmaker, and he made films in the early 70s, El Topo, which is this weird Western, and he made another film called The Holy Mountain, which is possibly the weirdest film you'll ever see. It is also one of the most spectacular films you'll ever see. It's almost impossible to describe The Holy Mountain. It's an odyssey that this character goes on that takes him into wild underworlds, but also into the farthest reaches of space. And Hodorowski is an incredibly, we could say, spiritual director, but he's just, his mind is open to everything. And he's one of those that knows all about the tarot, and he's all about esoteric religions and thought processes, but he's also very visceral in his filmmakings. His films are normally 18s for their violence and their sex, and sometimes their sexual violence. And he's quite a singular film director. I think he's 94 now. Anyway, in the 70s, after The Holy Mountain, he and his producer, Michel Simon, were going to make Dune. And for about 2 or 3 years, Hodorowski was in pre-production for this adaptation of Dune. And I think that the pre-production started in about 1974. And he brought in people like Chris Foss, who is one of the best sci-fi artists. He would paint the covers for Asimov books and had this gigantic scale that he would paint these ships on. So when I first saw Avatar and also the first Dune, when you see the scale of this and just how massive the ships are, it's like we are finally seeing Foss artwork in films. He also employed H.R. Giger, who would then go on to design Alien and Alien, to design the Harkonnen planet, Gedi Prime, and all of the things there. And there was someone else, Mobius, who the French artist Mobius, who was influential on the design of Blade Runner. And The Fifth Element as well. I think that Mobius actually worked on The Fifth Element with Luc Besson. So he got these three amazing artists to design this world. He got Dan O'Bannon, who'd done the special effects for Darkstar, to be the visual effects supervisor. And the cast he wanted, so Paul Atreides was going to be played by his own son, who spent 2 years of rigorous training, both mental and physical, so he became quite a martial arts expert to play the role of Paul. David Carradine was going to play Leto Atreides, Paul's dad. The Emperor of the Universe, played by Christopher Walken in this film, was going to be played by Salvador Dali. The Baron Harkonnen was going to be played by Orson Welles. And it's all these different things. And I mean, it's a real shame that the film didn't get made. I don't see how it could have been made. Because what Hodorowski talks about in terms of how this film was going to look was way beyond the capability of special effects at that time. It would have been made at the same time as Star Wars. And the things that it was going to be doing, apparently, at the time, would only have been able to have been done in animation. But it wasn't going to be animated, it was going to be a live-action film. Fade Rauther, played by Austin Butler in this film, and Sting in the David Lynch film, was going to be played by Mick Jagger. And Mick Jagger said yes, that he would do it, so he had signed on as well. And they basically created the Dune book. So Hodorowski and his producer, Michel Simon, created this Dune book, which was like a Bible. It was the entire film storyboarded, and all the concept art that had been done by these amazing artists, and all the production notes of how they were going to do all these things. Apparently the entire film was provable by this huge, huge hardback book that they produced for all the studios. All the studios got a copy of this book. And it's one of those things where it's like, I know that you would never be able to, or it would be very, very difficult to publish this book because of all the rights that you would have to clear from all the artists and maybe some revenue sharing with them as well because you're using their artwork. But oh my God, how much do I want that book? It looks fascinating. It looks like the Napoleon book that was published by Taschen about 15 odd years ago, that had all of Kubrick's notes in it and all of the costume designs and all that kind of stuff. It looks like that. It looks absolutely amazing. And yeah, the film fell through. Obviously, it never got made. but every studio had a copy of this book. And there is a segment of the film that says, look at this, and now look at these films. And other film directors were looking at this book, because there are some sequences in very, very big movies, like Prometheus, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, which seem very similar to some of the storyboards and some of the concept art in Jodorowsky's Dune. It's a really fascinating documentary, and Jodorowsky is interviewed at length in it and talks about his vision for it. I don't see how it could have ever worked. I think that the actual film itself might have been a complete disaster, but as a thing that never was, it's absolutely fascinating. And there are elements of this film, of Dune Part 2, particularly that thing on the Harkonnen planet, that seemed to have that kind of weirdness that we would have got throughout, I think, in Dune, Jodorowsky's Dune. So you should watch it.
I think it certainly would have been a different... That certainly would have been a different experience.
It would have been an 18. It wouldn't have been a 12. That's one other thing. I thought the violence in this film was very strong for a 12. What did you think of that?
I think mostly it was implied violence. I don't think we saw any blood. It did tend to cut on the blow.
Not always. There's a bit when the Beast Radon smashes someone's head against a console for quite a long time. And it's like, why you don't see blood? And that's the thing, is I think that's the get out that the BBFC are using so that they don't annoy the studios by giving films a 15. But there's a lot of casual throat cutting in it as well, which I thought was quite surprising for a 12.
Yeah, so the HR department for the Harkonnens is not great, is not doing a great job.
No, there aren't.
You do get the sense, if you slightly annoy any of them or catch them in even a slightly bad mood, then you're like, you know, I would not want to be the bearer of bad news.
Yeah, I don't think they send out any questionnaires to the people that work for the Harkonnen saying, how has this year gone for you? What are the kind of things we could do better?
It's like,
I don't think they really think in those terms. Yeah. Some of the violence I thought was quite strong. But anyway, maybe I'm just getting a bit conservative in my old age, because as a teenager, I would have loved this movie. It would have been like my film of the year, I think, just because of just how absolutely massive it was. But yes, so anything else before spoilers?
No, I think I'm good to go into the spoiler section. Oh yeah, the solar eclipse that occurs repeatedly throughout the film looks a bit like a Batleth from Star Trek, one of the Klingon warrior blades. That's my only other non-spoilery note.
Right, okay. Yeah, I was going to say you have to explain that. I have no idea what that is. Okay, right. Well, shall we do plugs and then get into spoilers?
Yes. Okay, Mr. Daniel, if our listeners are looking for you online, where can they find you?
And if you want to read my writing, you can do that at electric-shadows.com, including my review of Dune Part 2. You can find me on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/robdan. I'm also on Instagram at instagram.com/robdan75. And yes, if you have enjoyed us talking in depth about Dune Part 2 and you want to listen to us talk in depth about the film Highlander, I think the two go quite well together. Rob and I have also done another podcast called Another Time MacLeod, in which we go through the entire film scene by scene with some wonderful guests, and that's all available to listen to. It's called Another Time MacLeod, and it is available wherever you're listening to this. And one more time, it is called Another Time MacLeod.
Great. And yeah, if you're looking for me online, you can find my writing, such as it is, at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you want to follow this podcast, we're on Twitter, at Movie Robcast. You can also follow us on Instagram, at The Movie Robcast.
You can. And you can send us a movie-related email at movierobcast@gmail.com.
Great. So I guess now we will move into the spoiler section.
Yeah, so there'll be a little bit of the trailer, then you'll be in spoilers. So if you haven't seen Dune 2, then rush out and watch it. And come back for the spoiler section. And thank you for listening.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
So we are now in the spoiler section. I'm pretty sure this wasn't just my screening. I'm assuming this is the standard screening, that the first thing that you see in here, but when the film starts up, before you see the Warner Brothers logo or any of that, is the kind of Fremen language of saying power over spice is power over all, that plays out over black and is basically a jump scare.
Yeah, that was in my screening as well. Actually, one of the points I was going to say is that in that interview with Denis Villeneuve, he talked about how they had created an entire language for the Fremen. They got in a linguist to take the Fremen from the book and basically create an entire language for it. A language that worked as well, and it had its own inflections. And apparently there's one point in the film when Charney says, I think to Stilgar, you're insane. But that's a translation from the Fremen, because what she's actually saying is, you're drinking sand.
Yeah, so they came up with turns of phrase and aphorisms and...
Yeah, so they have idioms in this language as well. And it's like, it's very, very well put together. It's very well mounted, this film. Yeah, so what were the other spoilers that you were thinking of?
The spoilers that I was thinking of, well, the other actor who appears in a film whose trailer played just immediately before this one, is Anya Taylor-Joy, who is in Furiosa and also plays Paul's as-yet-unborn sister in this, of whom we get a vision.
I think her name is Alia?
Yes.
But the thing is, she is a character in the book, and she's also played by Alicia Witt in the Lynch film. So I think that this is a change from the book to keep her in utero the entire film, apart from that flash forward to Anya Taylor-Joy. But again, I haven't read the book, so but it seems to be that's the case, because she gets kidnapped in the book by, I think, by the Harkonnen. I was reading on Wikipedia. Do you remember in the book?
No, admittedly, I haven't read the book since I was in my teens, so I may revisit it. We can sync up.
Yes, we can. Well, you might read it a bit quicker than I. I sometimes struggle a bit with sci-fi.
Well, I'm going to listen to it on audiobook.
Oh, right, okay. So you will do the 20 hours. so that seems to be a change from the book. Not as radical as the end of Hodorowski's Dune. I won't spoil it here, but the ending to his film is out there, or for what his film was going to be. It's actually very similar to a film from a franchise that we've mentioned in this episode already, but I can't say what it is, because, say, the film, everyone will know what the ending is. But, so when do you watch the documentary?
I think based on your having said that, I figured out what it is.
What is it?
Well, I don't know, I think I might have figured out. I'm going to say it, and then you're going to cut it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Does it turn out the whole film's a flash forward, or a bunch of it is?
No.
It's a vision. Okay, so it's not It's not a Madame Web reference. Okay.
Oh, no. Have you just thought the end of Madame Web for me?
No. It does repeatedly during Madame Web. The end of Madame Web is not that. The end of Madame Web is an indifferent action sequence.
I now will leave that in. an indifferent action sequence. I think that's how it was described in that rewritten script that Dakota Johnson was talking about.
Yeah, I think that's when they storyboarded it, they just did one storyboard for it that just said indifferent action sequence.
Yeah, kind of the same way that in Kill Bill, the script for that didn't describe the action sequences because he didn't want them to be spoiled in any way. So he said, there is a fight scene, it will be awesome. That's what it said in the script.
Can I assume of Hodorowski's Dune that based on his other work, he was going to be treating Dune quite allegorically? And possibly in ways that that Frank Herbert never actually... Frank Herbert's like, no, there's obviously some allegories to, you know, invasion of the Middle East, etc. But it's also like a political drama in its own right. I'm guessing Hodorowski went, no, it's actually an allegory for a bunch of stuff that I'm just kind of making up.
Partially. I think he was going to be quite faithful to a lot of the book in terms of the spirit of the book, particularly the messianic elements of the book, which if you have ever seen Hodorowski in interview, you can see he's someone who's very, very comfortable with the idea of a messiah. He has quite an ego. I mean, he talks about the film and about how he's going to adapt the book in a way that will annoy a lot of people. It could be called quite an offensive way that he describes how the process of adapting a book to film. I wouldn't choose to use that particular phraseology for that. Yes, he is. I think in a book he wrote in the 70s, he said that he, to get the right performance from a female actor in one of his films, he basically sexually assaulted her, and then has spent a lot of time rowing that back, saying, no, it wasn't that, that was hyperbole. Sometimes he's his own worst enemy, I think. I don't want to spoil the Hodorowski's Dune documentary, but one of the reasons why there is no Dune film by him is him. But you'll need to see it to see what I mean. But anyway. So that's the reason why I thought there has to be a Dune 3, because Anya Taylor-Joy who was promoted as being in this film, is in it for about 30 seconds in a flash forward. Hopefully there will be a Dune 3.
The scene that I thought might be a flash forward is during the Paul and Fade Ratha fight. Because when Paul gets stabbed in the chest, I was like, well, that looks like a pretty fatal wound.
Yes.
That looks not unfatal. So I was wondering whether like we were actually going to see Fade Ratha kill him and then flash back and turn out that's Paul's precognition of the fight.
Right, okay, yeah. I thought that tied into the fact that Paul could be a messiah. Being stabbed is an image that ties in with the crucifixion and with the passion and things like that. So, but yeah, you're right. It did seem a little bit... That does look like a pretty serious wound there. I'm not sure you'd be able to carry on after that. Although, of course, we now live in a post-Scream 5 age where, what's her name, General Ortega gets gutted at the beginning of the film and half hour in has made a full recovery. So 5-foot-nothing General Ortega is like, really? She bounced back from that?
'Tis only a flesh wound to get one more in.
It was only a flesh wound. Yeah, that's right. but you're holding your stomach in. No, that's fine.
I mean, technically, all wounds are flesh wounds, so...
Yeah, indeed. It's just how deep.
To quote Brooklyn Nine-Nine, internal bleeding, but that's where the blood's meant to be.
Actually, another thing about the end fight between Paul and Fade Ratha is that in the book, Fade Ratha knows that he's going to lose, so he cheats and I think tries to poison Paul with like a poison blade or something at one point.
Well, that's very Hamlet.
Yeah.
And also both this film and the previous film end with a duel.
Yes, which I think again ties into the era that it was written in, and the whole thing about Dune was that it was... One, because Frank Herbert wasn't as interested in the technology as maybe other sci-fi writers, and was more interested in telling this story about another culture and about messiah narratives, that it's a galaxy where there was the pinnacle of technology and then something happened and a lot of it rolled back. So that he didn't have to go into, oh yes, I'm using this bit of technology and this bit of technology, that it was like, technology is not as great as maybe it should be for how far into the future we are, but there are spaceships. So I think there's an element there of like it being quite Arthurian in some ways as well. And there's a lot of swords and blades used in this film where you're thinking that, you know, in other films there would be laser guns and stuff. And it is interesting that this film has been released at a time when there is crisis in the Middle East. And the politics of this film, well, actually, I don't think that there are really politics of this film in terms of that particular situation in Gaza right now. But it's very easy to read in analogies between the Middle Eastern crisis and what the story of this film is because of the desert setting.
Yeah, it does kind of lend itself to, going back to the, you know, those allegorical readings. It turns out that a foreign presence in the Middle East has ended up being continually relevant.
That's right. It is one of those things, right? Because I think it would have been quite relevant during the 60s as well, because there were lots of things happening in Egypt at that time. There were tensions in Egypt. It's like the Middle East does seem to be the locus for tension in and of itself, but in also of the meddling and influence of foreign powers as well.
Yeah, so at the end of Dune Part 2, it is like, oh yeah, a white guy turned up and now we're getting a holy war.
That's right. And it is one of those things where it's either a very, very good fluke or very prescient of Frank Herbert to tell a story that was all set in a desert location that involves foreign powers mining a very, very precious substance. I mean, it's an oil metaphor, right? I mean, that's like, and that came across very strongly in the first Dune as well, in Dune Part 1. So if this film was released 20 years ago, like, yeah, literally 20 years ago with the invasion of Iraq, it would have again made absolute sense in terms of what it's commenting on at the time. So it's a bit depressing, really, to think that 20 years later it's also very relevant and current in terms of the story it's telling. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, so I think that's it from me on the spoiler front.
Is there anything else from me? Yes. At the end, when the other planets have all rejected Paul's demand that he becomes controller of Dune, is that right? And that basically the armadas are waiting outside the planet and that you're going to get a massive war. That was the point where I thought, this isn't an ending, is it? Because the ending of this film is very similar to the ending of the Lynch film as well, that it does end with the duel between Paul and Fade Ratha, but the Lynch film does wrap itself up as a much more of a traditional ending. There are some threads that are left, I think, that there could be a Dune Part 2.
As we both know, the David Lynch film never got a sequel. So, you know, he clearly didn't play it smart.
Yeah, that's right. He just told his story and everyone said that was absolutely satisfying, very good. And no, it's one of those films that when it came out, people were totally baffled by what was happening. And I have to say, when I saw the film again at the NFT years ago when there was a David Lynch season, hadn't seen it since I was a teenager, and actually had a dream. So I had a flash forward. I actually had a prescient vision for Dune, which is actually quite apt now I think about it. I dreamt that I was at the screening and all the reels were mixed up and it was all out of order. So none of it was making any sense.
And then you realise that was just the film, yeah.
When I went to see Dune, the first half hour was like, fuck, it's like my dream. I couldn't tell you anything that's happening right now. I don't know what's going on. And then when they get to Dune, it kind of, the story settles down and kind of makes a bit more sense. But you can see how an audience in 1984 watching that film at the beginning, particularly that opening 20, 30 minutes, would have been going, this isn't Star Wars, and who are these people, and why are they saying these things, and what does any of this mean? It was just a complete disaster. But again, it just has these flashes in it. It's a fascinating film because it fails so spectacularly. I mean, one of the things I presume, and again, I haven't read the books, I don't know, but this film ends kind of like the end of The Sopranos. Not in terms of Tony gets on a sandworm and rides away, but it ends in the middle of a character doing something. So Zendaya's going to get on her sandworm. And I thought, I can't imagine that the book gave as much importance to what Charney's doing as in the film, that she gets the final shot. And it really is one of those where you realise this is the end of the movie, right? This is the final shot. It just has that feel to it. Because I don't think that in 1965 that the female characters, and this could be doing a complete disservice to the book, but I think that Frank Herbert was more interested in his male characters. But to give the character more agency means that you also end on a massive cliffhanger for that character in terms of what she's going to do, because it suggests that she is going to form her own faction that's not religious, that is a secular insurrection group. And even though Paul has declared his love for her, he knows that tactically he has to marry Princess Irulan so that he can rule the galaxy. So what's she going to do with that? That is a massive plot thread left hanging for the two main characters. And it's like, well, as much as the Armada's floating in the orbit of Dune, we've got this huge emotional thing over here as well. You're going to have a Dune 3, right, for any of this to be satisfying. So, yeah, fingers crossed that there is Dune Part 3 or Dune Messiah, whatever they call it. They probably won't call it Messiah because that's a word that can become quite inflammatory sometimes in these odd times we live in.
Yeah, Dune Part 3 works because Dune Messiah, yeah, as you say, Dune Messiah might be quite inflammatory, and also it's just an unnecessary, let's go with Dune Part 3.
Because it is an arc, right? I mean, this is a trilogy. This is, Dune Part 2 is a middle part story. So, yes. Okay, then. Well, if there's nothing else to say about Dune Part 2, should we wrap it up?
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Daniel.
And thank you. And what are we talking about next time?
Blimey, what are we talking about next time?
I think it might be the Oscars.
Oh, wow. Yes, of course. We were talking about the Academy Awards.
So actually, there'll be quite a short wait between the episodes, won't there? Because we're recording this on Saturday, the 2nd of March, and the Oscars, so it will be relevant, will have to come out probably the week commencing the 11th of March. So yes, you won't have to wait too long for the next episode. And then after that, there will be two more episodes to go before we finish.
Yeah, not long. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Daniel.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back with you very soon.
May thy knife chip and shatter.